Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we want to take some time this Labor Day to reflect on a summer that many of us needed pretty badly. The pandemic has been with us well over 2 years, and whether it's the MBTA shutdown or inflation or any other of a number of things demanding our attention, sometimes you just need to revel in some good old-fashioned summer joy. So that's what we're going to do today. Before we close the books on the summer of 2022, we are looking back at some of our favorite moments of summer joy here on the show. Later in the show, we will hear from two ice cream makers who are thinking about the tasty treat in new, exciting, and surprising ways. We'll also get a crash course on making the perfect summer cocktail and even sample a bit of whiskey made with those little green crabs you may have seen scuttling across the beach. But first, we revisit a conversation with culinary superstar and Boston icon, Tiffany Faison. Tiffany was fresh off her latest Food Network project, Beachside Brawl, when she joined us in studio about a month ago. And we started by chatting about that show, what her experience leading the East Coast team taught her.
Little breezy, little beefy. Yeah. So it's the East Coast versus the West Coast. Brooke Williamson was the captain and mentor for the West Coast. I was captain and mentor for the East Coast. We got to choose our teams. We each had four culinary competitor chefs that came on and represented each coast. Antonio LaFaso was the host and also judge. It was from Brian Landung and Guy Fieri, who have a production company. So much fun. We actually filmed it earlier in the spring, but we just finished airing it. Spoiler alert, the East Coast does not prevail this time, but...
Yes, and we will talk about that. But yeah. I want to start, so you picked your team.
I did.
I have a question, because you have four people on the team. This is the East Coast team. We have one from Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. We have one from New Jersey. We have two from Florida. Mm-hmm. What exactly are we calling the East Coast here?
We are calling the entire Eastern Seaboard the East Coast. So we took a liberal scoop of the Eastern Seaboard for this. You know, it's interesting because I got to choose my team, but I also had to pick from people that reached out or the casting producers found. So
I did have
a pool of people. Exactly. So I started with probably about 20 people. And there were not a lot of people from like our area, from Boston and Cape Cod. I certainly would have maybe tried to have a more robust representation. But there we had a few people. I had Chef Ben, who was great, and he's from Harwich, has a restaurant in Harwich, and he did really well. All-star guy, just really sweet human being, really good cook, so I was happy to have him on my team. But I had him, Jared Brown from New Jersey, I had Jada Vidal from Florida, and then also Chef Edward Lorman from, like, he was kind of Florida, Alabama, like Pensacola area. So.
And he was the one that made it furthest.
He did. He made it the furthest. He and yeah. Jada. Jada was, like, next to last, and then Ed made it to the final with me.
Because it was a competition.
It was.
Somebody wins. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Brooke Williamson, who I know is a friend of yours.
Yes.
And I was so curious to see this because I got to go back a little bit. All right. So you bested her in the third Tournament of Champions.
Correct.
And my favorite moment still from that is when the two of you meet outside your trailer the morning of the finale. Here it is.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Ready to go down?
Ready to go. Good luck to you.
Down. I said go down.
No.
So I have to admit, I could not throw down with somebody like that face to face, but you did. So did this have that same competitive vibe? Because this time around, Brooke comes out on top. Last time, you clearly did.
Yeah. So it does have a competitive vibe. We're all such competitors. It doesn't matter what you put us in. If you told us all hold hands and save the world, we'd be like, which one does it first? Like, as much as we do enjoy each other and respect each other as cooks and as people, we're so competitive. So yes, I took Brooke down in season 3 of Tournament of Champions. She came back and took my East Coast team down. Let's split hairs. I'll take the L, but, there's agreeing with it and not agreeing. I'm not contesting it, but I really am so proud of my East Coast chefs, and I think that they just did such an incredible job. We had such a really incredible team. Like, the camaraderie and the sense of family and helping each other and what we learned together as the East Coast team was just, it was so much fun and extraordinary and really special, really special.
So let's talk about the food a little bit, and it may be because it's 11 a.m. and I'm hungry, but some of these recipes they had, you know, we're talking, you know, things like scallops and mm-hmm. coconut and pineapple and shrimp and yep. then lemongrass. And
sure.
What's like one dish that you're still fantasizing about? Like, I want to eat that again.
That someone made or that I made?
That someone made.
I think about Jada's fish and chips that she made right out of the gate. And it was, we all had to make like boardwalk specialties. And she did this really beautiful fish and chips with like a turmeric kind of curry battered on her fish. And then her chips were plantains with a chimichurri on top of it. And I never really thought about doing, I mean, we did it together, but I'd never really thought about doing plantains as the chip. It was so lovely. And just the fish came through, the plantains were great. Curry was really lovely, and then the chimichurri that she made, super bright, herbaceous, acidic. It was just really beautiful.
And I kind of can't imagine that there's any ingredient that you have never included with some other any ingredient, but did you discover from any of the chefs in this something new? I mean, like plantain chips, but
yeah.
where you're doing something different in your own cooking now as a result?
I learn from them all the time, and this is, I think, one of the things that's such a gift about new, having new people that come into the kitchens, whether it's on a competition, whether it's in the restaurants. And it's one thing I really say to new cooks that come in. So I sometimes feel, and I remember being 100,000 years ago when I was a new cook, I remember being so intimidated by being in a kitchen and the process and thinking that you couldn't contribute, thinking that you really had to keep your head down and sort of go through all of the lessons and the ropes and never open your mouth. And that was really, you know, the culture of kitchens. But I say it all the time to new cooks that come to the kitchen that there are things that will be obvious to you that might be easier or better or combinations of flavors that we should try that you don't think that you assume that we already know. And we don't, because sometimes we're just stuck in the fallacy of tradition or we don't see the thing that's right in front of us that'll make our lives easier or whatever. So we talk about mentioning that and not being afraid to say that. Conversely, we don't make fun of or put people down for saying things that might seem a little bit obvious if we have thought of it. If we haven't, it's not like, oh, we just don't do that. We think through it. Like, yeah. Think past the answer. Does it make sense?
And do you find that that's still the culture in Boston kitchens now, the keep your head down, don't speak up, do your job, learn the ropes? Or culturally, have our kitchens started to change?
I think it's not just speaking for Boston. It's speaking for all kitchens. I think there's a mix of both. There are kitchens that have changed culturally and welcome more collaborative environments in them. And then there are some that are just keep it down, don't talk, don't, you know. And if I'm being entirely honest, there are times when I'll have younger cooks that come in, and it's about knowing when to speak up and knowing, or, you know, finding a time to say something. Like having a brand new chatty Cathy that wants to tell you how to do your job all the time when they just started cooking 5 minutes ago is not my favorite environment in a kitchen.
How do you give that feedback?
We have a little conversation that's away from like the rest of the cooks about focus and making sure that I think the best contributors are always the best listeners.
Yeah.
And then when you have something that's really burning a hole that you need to say, let's say that.
So, you know, in the arc of this conversation just now, we went from TV to cooking, to being a chef. And I actually want to sort of meta talk about that mm-hmm. arc a little bit. I've been thinking, as I've gotten to know you better, I've wondered how you balance your life as a chef and a business leader and a mentor, which you talk about a lot with your own restaurants, mm-hmm. with your growing profile as a television personality and really a TV star. Are you finding that's an easy balance to keep? Is that tough?
No, it's totally tough. I don't think any balance is easy. When people talk about balance and what that means, I think it's not specific to my profession or having multiple different hats that you wear. I think what I've found is the idea of having it all, I think, is really a myth anyway. What is your all? What matters to you? Like, those are, I don't have children. I don't have, you know, I don't have that weight of my life to manage and hold. So in some ways, I don't have the commitment at home that a lot of women have. So I can kind of, you know, if I get home at 11 o'clock, midnight, 2, it doesn't matter. There's no one that's hungry that needs to be fed. And I don't have to deal with that side of my life. So that's been out of design and circumstance. But the other parts of it, putting on different hats, I think you can have parts of it at different times. I don't think you can have all of it all of the time. So it's about, for me, communicating what's happening in my life and what the priorities are at any given time. If I'm traveling and shooting a lot, then I have to communicate that to my teams, and they need to know that. And the people that support me in the business are aware of that. And then if there are times that I'm really like very focused on the restaurants and what we're doing and spending more time in the restaurants, then the other side of my life needs to know about that too. I can't leave for 2 days and bounce out and shoot something that doesn't matter. And not that things don't matter, but I'm not going to go do something that's like a one-off that isn't a part of something I'm already committing to.
And is that kind of the permanent future for you, that the finding the yin and yang here? I guess what I'm asking
you just asked me about permanent future, which is a non sequitur.
I'm sorry, what?
There's no permanent future anywhere.
So, but I guess what I am asking is, which one are you first and foremost? What's your calling?
I'm a chef. Yeah, I'm a chef first. And I think that will always remain. But your life changes, right? And it arcs and it moves in different directions. And I think sometimes, especially with chefs, there's this idea that if I'm not in my kitchens every second of the day, all the time, what is she doing? And I grew up with that, and I still hear it, not just myself, but other people were like, oh, she's not in her kitchen anymore. That chef's not in his kitchen. And there are times I'm like, guys, they've been cooking for 25 years. They don't have to be in their kitchens every second of every day. And if they are, maybe you should give more autonomy and teach better and give more to the people that work with you. So nothing is one thing forever. I am and will always be a chef. I do really enjoy this other side of my life, and it's a lot of fun. And it's not being a chef. It's just being a chef in a different way.
That was culinary superstar and Boston icon Tiffany Faison. She joined us in Studio 2 back in early August. Stay with us. Coming up, you can't possibly talk about summer joy without talking about ice cream. You just can't. So get your tasting spoons ready. We did. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and on this Labor Day, as summer hits the home stretch, or maybe is all the way behind us, we are bringing you some of our favorite conversations about summer treats and sweets. And this next one is definitely a sweet treat.
Half a gallon of chocolate, half a gallon of chocolate brownie fudge, half a gallon of chocolate chip.
Did your mom really write that shopping list?
Grandpa, what a question.
That's right, Lisa Simpson. We are talking about ice cream. And while we didn't get to chocolate chip, we did get to some pretty interesting flavors with Joe Gatto, local chef and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, and Gus Rancatori, owner of Toscanini's Ice Cream in Cambridge, when they joined us in studio in mid-July.
I mean, it's definitely, I'm sure like a lot of people in Massachusetts, it's going down the Cape, right? Mm-hmm. Down the Cape, the ocean, the beach. Black raspberry all day long with my family. You know, I still can taste it and remember it so well. And it's the same for my kids now. They are all addicted to black raspberry. I think those memories are what really drive forward for ice cream for, I think, everybody, right?
Yeah. All right. And how about you, Gus?
I think one of my favorite childhood memories might sound ambiguous or ambivalent, but I'm one of five children, and I remember my father confronting the Good Humor Man who always wanted to sell us five popsicles. And being a child of the Depression, he was inclined to get those popsicles that could be split in two and divided.
The ones you break in half.
Right. And so, we'd get half a popsicle and he might take one himself alone. It was kind of a frugal memory of a Depression baby, but that was a long time ago.
So when you then started, Gus, I'll stay with you for a minute, Toscanini's in 1981, mm-hmm. did you have some sort of mission for ice cream, having had that experience as a kid?
I'd worked for a long time at a place in Davis Square, Somerville, Steve's Ice Cream, which helped start or revive the idea of homemade ice cream and perhaps many other things. And so I'd worked there for a long time, and what I wanted to do was continue to do what Steve's did, which is make unusual flavors in small batches on site. And that's what we'd started doing.
All right, so we're going to have some fun with unusual flavors. And I'm going to lead us into that actually with a voice from one of our listeners. Everyone is excited about this segment today. We've gotten lots of yay ice cream. So we reached out to our audience through our texting group to ask them about their favorite places and flavors and memories like we've just been talking about. And by the way, if you want to join that texting group, text the word Boston to 617 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And Cheryl and Mattapoisett shared this particular memory and flavor.
My husband kind of knows I love ice cream and a little bit of an ice cream junkie. So this is a place called Katie's in Hyannis. And at the end of the season, I had him buy me 5 tubs of lavender honeycomb ice cream. I was absolutely in love with it. And so ever since then, I've been going back. And then eventually I ended up winning one of her contests to create a flavor, and it was glazed donut ice cream.
Okay, so Joe Gatto, maybe I'm just a traditionalist. Lavender honeycomb scares me off a little bit. Glazed donut has me kind of passing out wanting some.
Yeah, I'm going to go all in on that. Yeah, count me in. I want to try that. I want to see what it's all about. I really don't think there's many ice creams I'd turn down, to tell you the truth. I'm all in for all of them. Let's go.
And Gus, is there anything you really can't put in ice cream?
You can put almost anything in ice cream. The question is whether people will enjoy it and whether the ice cream maker will enjoy it and whether the customer will enjoy it. And at some ice cream stores, I guess I would describe them as having a more transgressive spirit than I really care for. And they're trying to do things that I suspect they intend to annoy your parents or your homeroom teacher with. And at Toscanini's, we're not trying to do that. We may be trying to surprise you. Like, I bet you didn't think this makes a good ice cream flavor, but we're not trying to annoy you.
All right, so surprise me without annoying me with one of the flavors in front of us, and all three of us are going to try it. What's the first one you want us to try that's a little surprising, Gus?
I think probably grape nut, which is a Caribbean flavor that a lot of customers wonder why we make, but it's very popular because we have a lot of people from the islands.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we put raisins in it, and sometimes we make it straight up with just grape nuts. If you go to Caribbean festivals like in neighborhoods in Brooklyn or even Franklin Park, you're going to see grape nut ice cream everywhere. Sort of surprisingly, grape nut ice cream is also popular with people from northern New England and the Maritime provinces. And I don't understand why there's this geographic discontinuity, but it is kind of an anomaly. So at Toscanini's, we either have people showing up for this flavor who are obviously who still have Caribbean accents, or people who look like they regular readers of Yankee Magazine.
So here's the thing. I actually grew up in Battle Creek, Michigan, and as a child loved grape nut ice cream.
Oh, really?
Absolutely loved it. Yeah, and so we're taking some tastes now. Joe, describe what you're tasting there.
I really liked that it had that crunch. I found that textural part of it fascinating, and that made me want more because I wanted to keep trying it. Because we brought one as well that we made last night that's Chipotle espresso.
So, and that's the one in the big tub here. So, folks, listen, we're tasting ice cream in here. We're going to have you hang with us, but I'm not tasting ice cream today. So I'm going to pull this tray over here for a minute. And Joe, tell us what's in the, this is the Chipotle here,
that's
right?
That's the Chipotle espresso.
I'm trusting you, Joe.
Yeah, please do, because it's going to surprise you. I mean, we wanted to do something different for today. And we also found that with the spice, the Chipotle, which is a smoked habanero and adobo, that the fats from the heavy cream and the milk are going to wrap your tongue, so you're going to get a little heat, but it's going to be tasty.
It's so good. I was so skeptical, and yes, all by the way, my mouth on fire a little bit right now.
So you need more ice cream,
right?
See,
<That's> right.
See what
it's
I did there?
It's tricky because you're like, then I need more ice cream, but then you're more on fire, and the espresso just
right.
Yep.
That's from my father-in-law, Ben. He does a lot of espresso at the house, so I had a grind there he usually gives me, and I use it for rubs for barbecue and stuff that come up during the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we wanted to do something for the show, I wanted to do something kind of off the wall, but make it still where it's, really yummy and kind of addictive. So I loved that I left the Chipotles just with little pieces because
I just
felt
got
like,
a piece.
Right, it chews like a cherry, but you still get that little bit of smokiness and heat with that espresso. I thought they played off each other and gave it what I'm always looking for when I'm cooking is balance.
Yeah. So, Gus, on this plate, what's one that's sort of one of your secret favorites? I want to try that, too.
We sell a lot of Indian ice cream flavors, most commonly called kulfi. Which usually has cardamom with chopped almonds and pistachios. But I believe that kulfi actually means simply means frozen dessert. And you know, because we're in a college town with a lot of South Asian customers, this was kind of an easy flavor to initially sell, and then it showed broadening appeal.
Mm. So I have to tell you, it tastes like a fruitcake if fruitcake tasted good, right? Which I do not think fruitcake take, you know what I'm saying. But this, delicious, the sweet and the cool of it.
If someone gave me this for Christmas, I'd be happy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But, Cassie, what do you think?
Can I give you a taste of this?
Yep. So Joe's daughter is here in the studio. She's a little one, so she's not mic'd, but she's tasting along as we go. Cassie, do I have a thumbs up on that? No, we got a medium thumb.
Medium.
I think this might be an age thing, right? My palate was a lot more adventurous. So let's have you both talk about that a little bit. Young palates versus older palates and what people want in ice cream accordingly. Go ahead, Joe.
I mean, I really do think, I mean, we were just talking back and, you know, it is age appropriate. You know, kids want something that's simple, that's yummy, that, you know, where, I mean, I do too. I'm still looking for that. But I also like something that challenges my palate. And that's interesting, and that makes me think, wow, you know, how did they put these flavors together? That last one that you compared to fruitcake, I think was, I mean, that was really complex, and I really liked eating it. It made me want more, and I think that when you get older, you are looking for that. But, of course, I'm also looking for that simple, I just want to sit on a wall and just lick a cone of vanilla.
Yeah. Anything in this tray that is along that simpler line that you brought, Gus?
Well, there's French vanilla, and we also brought over two kinds of chocolate ice cream. We brought over a milk chocolate, and we brought over a dark chocolate.
Dark chocolate.
Oh, dark
chocolate. Sorry, did I reveal that out loud? No. I wasn't sure if I kept that to myself or not.
So that's this one.
All right, this is the dark chocolate. I'm going to lean away. I'm leaning away to get my spoon. I'm going to taste it first. Tell us simple ingredients here, Gus.
Most of these ingredients are simple, although they're fairly high quality. So that cocoa pudding ice cream, which is what we call our dark chocolate, it's made with imported cocoa from France, I think. And the Belgian chocolate, which is the milk chocolate, is made with chocolate from a famous chocolate company in Belgium. And over the years, we've got all sorts of help in developing flavors from vendors and very informed customers. And I remember these two people who were early distributors to us, and they said, you know, just use different chocolates and you'll get dramatically different flavors. And, you know, sometimes when you're looking at cookbooks or when you're at a restaurant and you wonder, why does this taste so much better than something I could do at home or have done at home? The answer is simply they get better ingredients.
The sourcing, yeah.
Sourcing's really important.
So I got to confess to you, up until this very moment, my all-time favorite ice cream was chunky chocolate pudding from Bedford Farms, which I still love, so shout out to Bedford Farms. But what is this called, Gus, this chocolate thing?
Well, this is just cocoa pudding.
Cocoa pudding. Holy cannoli. So now I think cocoa pudding might now be my favorite. All right. So I'm going to bring us back to the childhood memory a little bit. We got another call from one of our listeners, Richard in Braintree, about memories of making ice cream at home with his dad.
My father was the champion ice cream maker for the whole family. He had a wooden bucket with a hand crank type thing and a metal cylinder into which you would put all of the ingredients. You could put almost anything in there, strawberry, peach, make vanilla if you wanted to. So it was a wonderful treat during the summertime for a young boy and great memories.
So Joe Gatto, you are the From Scratch Chef. You are the make it at home guy.
Yeah.
So I'm completely intimidated about the thought of making ice cream at home. De-intimidate me.
This is just a very simple process. I mean, you're using ingredients that you typically have at home. You're using milks, heavy cream. You can make it simple. I think it's called a Philadelphia style when there's no eggs involved in it, right? And I mean, you can take the eggs out of the equation and just go with simple milk, heavy cream, sugar that you're just melting down into the, you know, you can steep espresso. I mean, the one I made, it took us like 20 minutes to make and then 20 minutes in the ice cream machine. An ice cream machine is going to make it super simple. This is something you can really do with ease at home and still get a really quality product. But I think what Gus said is exactly right. It's all about your ingredients. You want to get the best high quality ingredients and you're going to get a really good product. I mean, this is so easy. It's like making pasta at home. It sounds like it's crazy and it's going to take forever, but it doesn't. It's really simple, very approachable, and great to do with the kids.
All right. And Gus Rancatori of Toscaninis, if one is going to start with a simple flavor, what's your favorite most simple to start with?
I'll change that question and tell you some flavors that I think are hard to make at home, which everyone tries.
Okay.
Strawberry. Strawberries in the United States are grown to be big and durable, and they don't have as much flavor as you might remember if you grew up on a farm or had the fortune to live in France. There are flavors like coffee ice cream or variations on coffee, chocolate, peanut butter. These are kind of rich ingredients that come across very quickly in ice cream. The other thing is, if you're only going to make ice cream like once a year or twice a year, because someone gave you an ice cream maker for Christmas and so let's use it this year, you're not going to get very good results. If you make ice cream once a month, it's going to be dramatically better. You're going to become familiar with what you're doing and begin to recognize some of the things that happen.
I think a lot of listeners will be like, okay, so the commission is make ice cream every month at home. It's really the only way to do it.
Oh, I got every week out of that. Sorry.
All right. And listen, before we let you go, Joe Gatto, you also accidentally made a vegan ice cream recently. We have a lot of vegans who listen, so tell us.
Just using coconut milk, and like it just kind of came together really quick with a little vanilla, just coconut milk. I had a little coconut creamer, and next thing you know, we're popping it in the ice cream maker. And again, I think Gus is making so many great points. When you're familiar with what it's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to react, it was really simple. And it came out fantastic.
Delicious.
It was really, really easy. Just a little bit of sugar. That's all we add. Oh, actually, no, it was monk fruit.
Mm. So you didn't even add sugar?
No.
Monk fruit. All right. There you go. Joe Gatto is host of From Scratch. And Gus Rancatori is owner of Toscaninis Ice Cream. It has been a delight, the two of you. Thank you so much.
I'm going to eat all of this ice cream.
Joe and Gus joined us here in Studio 2 back in mid-July, and I can still taste that cocoa pudding. Stay with us. Coming up, let's wash the ice cream down with the perfect summer cocktail. I'm Tisiana Deering, and you're listening to Radio Boston. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering, and on this Labor Day, we are spending some time reflecting on this past summer and revisiting some of our favorite moments of summer joy. What better way to end today's show than with a heartfelt cheers to summer 2022. Now, if you're a regular Radio Boston listener, you know that means Lonnie Newbern, owner of the Boston Shaker, which is a craft cocktail shop in Somerville. But before we get to Lonnie, we couldn't share our summer cocktail segment with you without also offering you a little nip of one of the most memorable things I have ever sampled on air, crab-flavored whiskey. And for that, we were joined by Will Robinson. He is a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire. And I was joined here in Studio 2 for the tasting by Alicia Lumia, a founding board member of the organization GreenCrab.org. We had just finished a conversation about concerns over the invasive species of green crabs that Will's whiskey is actually made with. Before I pulled the cork, I just had to ask Will, what on earth made you think to make a crab-flavored whiskey?
Well, I have a little bit of a culinary background as well. I've done a lot of cooking professionally in my past, and I've always been intrigued by cultures that use certain ingredients that may be considered off on their own. For instance, in Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and Thailand, fermented fish sauce is a very popular ingredient in a lot of their dishes. And that as an ingredient by itself is repulsive. You would not want And so crab, you know, can kind of be a similar sort of thing. I figured it could be a similar sort of thing. And I'm from the Deep South originally. So I grew up cooking, you know, a lot of Louisiana cooking and low country boil and those type of things. And so in researching it, I did a lot of research into the, you know, we have about a 300-year history of seafood spice blends here on the East Coast, different types of spices used, but there's kind of like a homogenous group of them that have been used continually on the East Coast for 300 years. And as I delved into that, you know, as a potential way of working with the crab, I was able to learn how a lot of these spices that are used in the blends were actually added so that they could curb some of the offensive, what we consider offensive and consider offensive in a raw crab, in a crab by itself, you know, this, the aroma and the taste. And so ended up working with those spices to curb it. And it, I think it worked out really well.
All right. Actually. So let's pause there for a second. So you sent us a small bottle sample. It says right on it, Crab Trapper, green crab flavored whiskey. It came in this little green metal crab trap, basically. And it's piqued quite a bit of curiosity around here at WBUR. And Alicia, I understand you're quite curious to taste it as well.
Very.
All right. So here's what we're going to do. I got a couple shot glasses here. I'm going to pull the cork off. I took the wax off before the show, but hopefully you can hear that now. While I pour it so that Alicia and I can get ready to taste it, Will, tell us a little bit about how you make it.
Unlike a lot of distilleries around, we use a very kind of highly advanced technological process called vacuum distilling. So we have some lab-grade glass stills that are able to operate under vacuum. And what that does is it allows us to distill aromas and flavors that might be destroyed under heat in a normal still, because you can boils at a lower temperature under vacuum, Boyle's law, etc. So I make a crab stock from the crabs and then remove the solids. Well, I clean them and make a stock just as if I was going to cook them and serve them.
Like a soup stock almost.
Right, exactly. And then I reserve the liquid, remove the solids, and I fortify that with some of our neutral grain spirit, which is kind of like a vodka. It's like our base spirit that we make to make gins and vodkas and those type of things with. And then we distill it in the rotovap is what the vacuum still is called. And the distillate then is blended in with a four-year-old reserve whiskey, bourbon reserve, you know, corn-based whiskey. There's our whiskeys are very, it is very corny. So there's a lot of corn there. There's a lot of nice barrel character as well.
Kind of an amber color.
Yeah, and there's some caramel and some vanilla and a little bit of maple that goes along with that. Off the top, if you were to smell the crab distillate by itself, you might get a whiff of what are called amines or amines, which are nitrogen-based compounds similar to ammonia. If you've ever noticed seafood, especially seafood that is bad, can burn your nose a little bit.
Yes.
So we use coriander as a spice for the top notes, and the coriander blends with those amines, and you don't even notice they're there. So a lot of people may, when they approach it at first, if they're not deeply familiar with seafood smells and the spices, they may not smell the crab off the bat.
No. All right. So we're going to take it back from you here. Stand by, sure, because we have them in our shot glasses now. Alicia, smell it. And what do you think when you smell it?
I smell the vanilla and the spice more.
Yeah, the spice, the coriander, and whiskey. What I don't smell, Will, is crab. So stand by, Will. We're going to do this one at a time. You want to go first or second, Alicia?
I'll go first.
You're first. You're up. Go ahead. Take a taste. And what do you think?
It's delicious.
Yeah.
The spice is definitely there, and I think you get a little, I can taste the shellfish on the back.
Okay, so my turn here. I'm going to take a sip. Okay, so first, let me just say it hits like whiskey, right?
It does.
That's my first, and it tastes like, and you're right. Okay, so when you first taste it, first you get whiskey, then you get spices, and then at the very end, you get a little bit of shellfish. Does that make you happy, Will, when you hear that that's the tasting experience here?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And instead of walking away, I don't know if you've noticed, but like there are some of the other spices in there are clove, cinnamon, allspice.
Yes.
And those are heavy oils that coat your tongue so that you finish with that instead of walking away with a marsh mouth, so to speak.
That is correct. I do not have marsh mouth, but I do still have some of that clove, especially. I'm a big fan of clove. All right, so this is what's possible. Now, quickly, Will, how many crabs to make a batch of this?
Somewhere in the order of about 1,000, which is about 80 to 90 pounds.
Okay. And, Will, I got to ask you, you know, there is something remarkable about this entire story, including the fact that I'm drinking this invasive species. When you made your first batch and you went to taste it for the first time, I just got to know, what was your reaction, just quickly?
I actually filled a small vial with it and risked my driver's license driving around smelling it. I was not tasting it as much, but the aroma, just opening it back up and taking it in and thinking about it, because it was so there's a lot of depth to it. And I wanted to make sure. I was like, my impulse was like, this is good. But then I kept questioning myself because it didn't have a lot of input on it. Other input. So I'm constantly going back and smelling it. I still find myself, if I see an open bottle somewhere, I have to take a whiff.
That was Will Robinson, a distiller at Tamworth Distilling and Mercantile in New Hampshire, and Alicia Lumia, a founding board member of the organization GreenCrab.org. They joined us on the show back in July. So now, I hear you. What about those of us who want to drink but maybe are not in the mood for whiskey that has a shellfish kick? Well, you know Lonnie Newburn has you covered. Lonnie, who is the owner of Boston Shaker, which is a craft cocktail shop in Somerville, also joined us in July. And I, along with another guest taster, Adam Chapdelaine. Now, he's a town manager who had joined us earlier in the show for a segment on town managers, but stuck around for a taste. And we got to enjoy a couple of really refreshing beverages. Lonnie started by telling us about what makes the perfect summer cocktail.
Summer means light and bright. You know, everybody's kind of outside, the sun is shining, you're having more group gatherings, so you want something you can have as a sessionable drink to get you through the afternoon and into the evening. We've actually chosen a few lighter alcohol ingredients, including one that's zero alcohol, just because you want to have more than one. You want to be able to have a nice, refreshing afternoon on the porch or on the beach. And so we've chosen a lot of fresh citrus, some fresh herbs from the garden. We have a really unique local vermouth, and we're going with some fresh yuzu and grapefruit flavors.
And my understanding is that more and more people are turning to non-alcoholic cocktails, that mocktails have really started to kind of come into their own.
That's correct. I mean, the segment of non-alcoholic has definitely been growing. We at the Boston Shaker see a lot of requests for low ABV or no ABV cocktails, and we have a whole section of non-alcoholic beer. We carry non-alcoholic spirits. And all of our mixers and bitters are great with zero alcohol.
So before we get into the drinks, Adam, have you done any gatherings this summer where people have made cocktails or there's that social gathering around the summer drinks?
So my first big one like that is this Saturday. I'm going to a party. People from across the community where that will happen.
So these cocktail recipes might be good for you.
Yes, yes.
And Lonnie, this has been on our minds because you mentioned how great it is to be back in the studio, right? It was challenging. We'd do this remotely and I'd shake stuff in my mic in my house and you'd shake stuff, right, to mix these. We're together now and we are relearning how to be together. How do summer cocktails help us be social?
Yeah. Yeah, we too switched to more virtual the last few years, but it's great to be back in person, hands-on guiding people on how to do the techniques behind cocktails. But for group gatherings, it's about the socializing. It's about bringing friends back together. It's about enjoying yourselves and the weather, given the moment, and just enjoying life. And that's what the Boston Shaker's here. We're just bringing a good time, trying to help people learn a classic hobby that can help impress their friends at home.
So I know you brought us accessible recipes today, yeah. But before we do that, we do want to ask you, what's your favorite summer cocktail? Because you can make anything.
I do drink seasonally. I still go for the classic daiquiri. It's simple, much like the drinks we're going to make today. It's rum, lime, and sugar shaken. Good time anytime.
All right. So got two recipes for us. You've put two little snifter yep. sort of things in front of me here. So how do you want to start this?
Well, I was going to say, we're going to start with the light yuzu lime spritzer. And so the first sample you have in front of you is actually the first base ingredient, which is not hard alcohol. It's actually vermouth.
Okay.
You've chosen a local vermouth
here.
Wait,
vermouth is not hard alcohol?
No, this is more of like a fortified wine. So okay. It has the same ABV as like wine. This is around 15% alcohol or 30 proof.
Ooh, I am tasting that.
Yeah, this is
Ooh,
the dry zephyr.
You can taste that.
And this is a very herbaceous vermouth. It's going to stand up well to the nice citrus. But it starts as a lower alcohol base so we can have a really nice sessionable spritz, which is usually a cocktail that has bubbles and fortified wines, aperitifs like Aperol or even Amaros. So
spritzes have lower alcohol, less heavy, hard alcohol kinds of ingredients.
Exactly.
And bubbles.
Yeah, coming from Italy, it's all about the day drinking. It's all about effervescence and fun, refreshing, not gonna make you too tired.
All right, so take us through the yuzu lime spritzer. I see you're holding the vermouth
you bottle
there.
You got it. Yeah, I'm just going to measure into a Boston shaker. I am going to start with the main ingredient here, which is the vermouth. And we're just going to do 2 ounces of it. That's a common measurement for most base spirits. So instead of using a gin, or you could use a vodka, or even a rum in this cocktail, we're just going to use the lighter vermouth. I cut a lime in half here. I'm going to use a hand juicer. And I'm just going to squeeze half of a lime.
Kind of looks like a garlic press.
Exactly, there. Like a large garlic press. Just squeeze that fresh citrus. Fresh citrus is key when making bright cocktails. It's going to make it so much more delicious. And then this one, it just calls for a little bit of bitters. And we're pairing with the kind of lime and the vermouth flavors, those kind of herbal flavors, with this yuzu bitters, which is like a bitter Japanese citrus.
And what are bitters?
This is like an extract of flavor. Basically, this one's made with peels and citrus from the yuzu citrus fruit. And this is extracted using alcohol. And they put other herbs in them like gentian root and grains of paradise and things that actually have a nice little spice to them. So they're, think of like salt and pepper for cocktails. They bind things together. You just dash them in. They make the flavor and aroma much better.
And you basically kind of shook that in there like it was salt or pepper, just a few shakes.
Like a hot sauce bottle. Just want to invert the bottle and dash.
Adam, have you ever tried bitters before?
I don't think I have. This is all a new experience.
Yeah, you can certainly try these yuzu ones. They're great on their own. You can just have bitters and soda is like the most common way. So if you're doing less sugar, you can just do bitters and soda.
So does it matter what kind of ice you're kerplunking into the shaker there right now?
I'm using the same ice you can use with the molds we sell at the shop. We have the everyday ice tray here. We sell spheres and large cubes and even Collins cubes, but the most versatile one is just the 1-inch cube here. That's what I'm using.
The basic ice cube.
Yeah. I'm actually filling up the small half of the shaker all the way to the top, and now I'm going to cap with the larger 28-ounce tin.
Bam!
That gives a nice seal.
You hit that top onto the bottom.
And then you just want to put your right hand on top or dominant hand and just shake over that same shoulder for about 10 seconds.
Okay, so this is Lonnie Newburn, owner of the Boston Shaker, shaking the Yuzu Lime Spritzer while Adam cracks up, our guest taster here, watching. And there's like a thing to the way you shake correctly,
yep,
correct?
You want to shake it up, wake it up. You want to keep the tin horizontal as opposed to vertical. You're just going to keep the ice going back and forth so it really mixes everything, chills it, of course, but also dilutes it. You want to add a little bit of water to this cocktail.
Now, you put a strainer in the top. Is that I don't own a strainer. Is that necessary?
Yeah, we're actually going to strain using a Hawthorne strainer. This is the original design from 1895, and this was invented right here in Boston. And this is what goes in the larger tin is what you want to strain out of, and it holds back all the ice, any of that citrus pulp, and if we were to muddle like any mint in there, it would actually hold back the herbs as well.
Now, Lenny, you held back the ice, and yet you're pouring it over ice.
Yes. Ice is one of those secret ingredients. It's actually one of the most important come summertime cocktails. Whether you're shaking, serving punches, always prepare with a little bit more ice than you think. Because even when you're done shaking, that ice has done its job. It's really melted. It's a little more wet. It's lost its edges. And we just strained over fresh ice in a Collins or a highball glass.
Adam, what's your question?
No question. I'm learning.
Yeah.
All right.
And then the one thing we left out was the soda. You never shake with soda in your glass. So I'm pouring the Fever Tree Yuzu Lime Soda. And this is what makes this really a highball, an effervescent, a long drink. And it's what makes it a great porch sipper because you can just enjoy it over a long period of time. So this is the Yuzu Lime Spritz. I'm just going to garnish with a lime wheel and just some fresh mint from the garden, as that's like pretty prevalent these days.
Yeah.
And so that's your Yuzu
All right,
lime
actually,
spritz.
I'm going to have Adam taste it.
Oh, I have a little sample for him as well.
Oh, great.
Yeah, right here.
Great. So while you're pouring Adam's, I'm going to take my taste.
Please
right?
do.
Here we go.
There you go, Adam.
So I caught that mint right away.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of tartness to it. It's a little tart as well. And I'm telling you, Lonnie, I do not taste. Adam, can you taste the alcohol?
No.
No, right? No. So what does it taste like to you?
It is effervescent. It is. I can taste the lime. I don't feel like I can taste the bitters. And I mean, it feels like a long drink, like you just described it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, if I were really thirsty without tasting the alcohol and all that citrus in here, I could imagine maybe too quickly going, gloom, gloom, gloom,
yeah.
getting this one down.
We left sugar out of this one. It's just more of a refreshing punch. You could easily build this in like a pitcher or even like a larger punch bowl just by topping these three ingredients.
Yeah.
So yeah, effervescence. The bitters give it kind of an oily finish. And again, you could leave out the alcohol or obviously substitute with gin or vodka in this
one. And you liked it, Adam. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. All right. So now we're going to go to your non-alcoholic, the mocktail.
Correct. Yeah. We actually are going to make a classic riff on another highball or delicious summertime cocktail, the Paloma. The Paloma is traditionally made with tequila, lime juice, and grapefruit soda. It's a refreshing kind of hot beach summer drink, and it's great anytime. However, to make that non-alcoholic, we're actually going to be featuring a new product we have at the shop. We have the Monday line of zero alcohol spirits, and they just came out with a non-alcoholic mezcal.
And that's in this little glass that I'm going to sip,
so I
right?
poured you the non-alcoholic mezcal from Monday. This is completely zero alcohol, although they're using like kind
wow.
of green pepper flavors, roasted agave, and emulating the flavor and texture of tequila.
That is peppery.
Yeah, exactly. They want to add a little spice to this, and that's what makes this cocktail a little more zippy. So we're actually just going to substitute 2 ounces of actual mezcal or tequila with 2 ounces of non-alcoholic, which is makes this a lot easier to translate, and we can just build this one in the glass.
All right.
So,
while you're pouring, Adam Chapdelaine, who's a guest from earlier in the show who stayed to be our taster, my throat's a little bit on fire after that.
Same. I would have never guessed it was non-alcoholic.
Yeah, that's right.
We've tried a lot of the non-alcoholic spirits that have come to market. We really like the Monday because it has a little more flavor.
Yeah.
and a little spice for those looking to add the same kind of textures of spirits to their classic drinks.
So Lonnie Newbern of the Boston Shaker, you've poured some of this, and I already forgot what it's called.
We have the Monday Mezcal. This one we don't have to shake. We're just going to build it in the glass. So we poured 2 ounces of Monday Mezcal in a Collins or highball glass. I have a nice little ice spear in there to keep this cold.
And they're nice and square. You talked about the edges of the ice. Mm-hmm. That's important, huh?
Yeah, when you start moving or stirring ice, shaking or stirring, it's those little edges that melt first and really give you the water. So you want a solid cube that's going to be able to crack easily, give you that nice chilled cocktail that lasts a lot longer in the glass.
And you just strained some lime,
yep.
Was that in there?
Common ingredient in both these is the fresh lime. It's kind of summer tropical, so I literally just took a half a lime using that large juicer, and I squeezed that right into the glass right after the tequila.
Why lime and not lemon?
You know, tequila is just naturally paired with lime. Same with rum. It just kind of naturally, there's a lot more cocktails that call for lime, where whiskey is more commonly paired with lemon and things like that.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Once you start making a few drinks, you kind of realize the relationships, and you can start making your own flavor pairings. To spice this one up, we are using some more bitters. We have the El Guapo Cuban bitters. These are non-alcoholic bitters. They're one of the two on the market. And they're out of Louisiana. So this has sour orange, lime, cinnamon, some coriander. And I'm just going to invert the bottle. It won't come out until I start bouncing. I'm going to dash 4 to 6 times just over the lime mezcal.
Like a Tabasco sauce bottle almost.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of shake it out.
Exactly. This one's adding that nice cinnamon kind of flavor. And this one, too, is a highball. Only instead of lime, using lime from Fever Tree, we're going to be using their sparkling pink grapefruit. And I'm just going to be topping this with the pink grapefruit to kind of create that Paloma flavor, which is grapefruit, lime, and tequila. This one also has a lime garnish since it has the lime citrus, so just a little bit of a lime wheel on the side.
All right. So while you pour a sample for Adam, yep. I'm going to taste this, and I want to describe to listeners, it's very pink. It looks almost like if you imagined what pink champagne would look like. There's bubbles coming up the glass. Very pink, like flamingo, but not garish. I'm going to take a taste here.
Yeah, the Paloma, especially with that grapefruit juice, has a signature kind of pink color.
Oh, yeah. Now, that is fantastic. It's very grapefruity, very refreshing, right? All that pepper that sort of intimidated me, Lonnie, no longer tastes intimidating. Hey, Adam.
Same. It smoothed it right out. That's delicious.
Yeah. And I would drink this, yeah?
I would.
Just a little subtle heat makes it nice, a little spicy. But yeah, this is another great classic highball. New England's known for a lot of their old school Cape Codders and sea breezes, but these would be kind of more contemporary styles of highballs.
So you're proud of both of these drinks, Lonnie. What makes you so proud of them?
I think they're using unique ingredients, whether they're the local ingredients, which are, I think, better made. Some of the large batch vermouths, instead of grabbing Martini and Rossi, definitely look for like something that's made in your region, like New England. And yeah, this non-alcoholic mezcal, this is the first of that on the market. So I'm really excited to kind of share that with people and talk about this whole new world of non-alcoholic cocktails.
So Adam, if you were going to try to make one of these this weekend when you're at your gathering, do you have any questions for Lonnie about what you would need to know?
How do you make those ice cubes?
Yeah, I just use we have the silicone molds, and we just fill those up and put them in the freezer. We do cocktail classes, so we don't have like an ice maker. We just use the same molds you would have at home. This makes a really good dense, you know, semi-clear cube. It's a little better than the half moons coming out of your freezer door. Those are more brittle, so shake a little less. So really the ice program at home is important, but even during the summer it becomes more important because of the heat. So you want to, if you can, bank some ice, maybe the larger cubes that you can use the 2-inch cube in like punches, or when stirring, or larger
like
format
cocktails. Like those big ones people use in scotch or whiskey.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have the 2-inch cubes, we do spheres, we have clear ice molds. So it's really a whole other aspect of the cocktail world, but it's fun to get into.
So Lonnie, we've got about a minute left. Tell us, as the owner of Boston Shaker, you do these cocktail lessons. Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. We've been teaching cocktail classes for over 8 years now. The business is going to its 15th year, and we're proud to bring education as part of our offerings to people. And that is mostly teaching them how to master the basic tools. Just like cooking, when you have that confidence on how to shake and stir, you can apply it to all your favorite flavors. So we host the classes twice a month at our store location in Davis Square, Somerville. It's limited to about 10 to 12 folks, but we try to get everybody in. And right now we're teaching the daiquiri and the old-fashioned, and in that, how to shake and how to stir. We talk about ice, taste all the spirits, and really get into how to make drinks at home.
Okay, very quickly, one tip on a great daiquiri and a great old-fashioned.
Shake it long enough, or stir it long enough. Shake the daiquiri for at least 10 seconds so it's ice cold, little chips of ice. Stir that old-fashioned. All the recipes are simple. Stir that old-fashioned for at least 20 seconds to make sure it's ice cold and diluted just to be perfect.
That was Lonnie Newbern, owner of the Boston Shaker, which is a craft cocktail shop in Somerville. And he joined us back in early July. I'm Tiziana Dearing, and on behalf of the entire Radio Boston team, we hope you are having a lovely Labor Day weekend. And we also hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.